Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The GOP Ohio Senate yesterday voted 17-16 in favor of a bill that would restrict collective bargaining rights for 350,000 plus teachers, police, firefighters, prison guards, and other public workers across the state of Ohio. Coming up later, we'll talk with two political strategists about the fallout from SB 5, Senate Bill 5. Joining us now is Bill Cohen of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks.
So is it all quiet at the State House today?
Well, it's sure a lot quieter than it's been the last 2 weeks, I'll tell you that. You know, in past days, we had, you know, 8,500 union activists protesting this bill. We had hundreds of Tea Party people for the bill with picket signs and marching and chanting all over the place. You're right. Today is very, very quiet. No hearings on the bill scheduled and at the moment today, and no mass demonstrations.
House Speaker Bill Batchelder has promised to set an aggressive schedule of hearings in the House. Why the rush? Why aggressive?
Well, because the backers of this bill would like to have it passed and signed into law by the first week of April. They worry, quite realistically, that probably after this bill does pass, the critics of it will hit the streets and collect whatever it is, something like 200,000 petition signatures, and that would block the bill from taking effect until the next major election and would put basically the new law up for a vote by the people. The backers of this bill believe that, I think quite accurately, that if there is a referendum on this new law this year, a non-presidential year, an off-year election, the law would have a better chance of surviving. On the other hand, if the Republicans wait a while, a month or two, and then pass the bill, if there were a referendum, the referendum would be next year. That'd be a presidential year when there'd be a high voter turnout. Democrats would more likely turn out in bigger numbers, and that would mean that the new law might have a better chance of being rejected by voters.
This bill had a sponsor, no co-sponsors. That's kind of unusual.
I don't know. I think that's really more of a technicality.
It is.
I mean, I think it's no secret that most of the Republicans in both the House and Senate strongly back this bill. And so to me, that doesn't really mean much.
It is a technicality, but I was wondering why. Why this time?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't looked into that because I haven't really thought it was very important since, you know, the majority Republicans. I mean, you can grab any of the majority Republicans around here, and almost to a man, not totally, but almost to a person, they'll give you a good interview on why this is a good idea.
It was a narrow vote yesterday, 17-16. Six Republicans went with the Democrats. Also, two Republicans were displaced in their respective committees. What happened with that?
Well, yes, there were, as you point out, there were six Republicans who bolted party ranks and voted against the bill with Democrats. And there was a time in the morning when it was at least it was theoretically possible that the bill wouldn't even get out of the Senate Commerce and Labor Committee, because two Republicans on that panel wanted to vote no, and if they did, the bill would just be sitting there in a tie vote. And so the Senate President, Tom Niehaus, yanked one of those senators, Bill Seitz, and replaced him with Cliff Height, and that ensured that the bill would get out of that committee. Then they had to get it out of Rules Committee. They faced a similar situation. Scott Olslager, another Republican defector, he was going to vote no in that committee, and that would have kept the bill in the Rules Committee. And again, Niehaus put somebody else in, substituting for Olslager, and that got the bill out of the Rules Committee and onto the Senate floor. This is a somewhat rare maneuver, but it's been used in the past. It's it's not unheard of. It's been used by Democrats and Republicans whenever one party is in power and they worry that some bill is trapped in committee, and they believe they have the votes to pass it on the floor, but it's trapped in committee. They don't hesitate to yank somebody off that committee and put somebody on the committee who will help get that bill out.
My guest is Bill Cohen from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. If you have a Question or comment for Bill, 614-292-8513. You can also email us, but I caution you, keep the emails short. They will not get read on air if they are not tight. We just don't have enough time to do the editing necessary to get them pared down. So you can email us at allsides@wosu.org and keep it spare, and they'll have a lot better chance of getting read on the air. Bill, any coincidence that Senators Olslager and Seitz are both long-serving Republicans in the Ohio General Assembly?
Any coincidence? Well,
they're not new. They're not new to this.
No, they're not new. And they, Seitz especially, known kind of as a constitutional expert, very well respected, pretty conservative, too, Seitz is. I think Olslager more moderate. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of interesting that that a couple of conservatives voted no, Tim Grendel and Bill Seitz among them. And they just said the bill went too far. They said, yes, we should tighten up collective bargaining. Things have gotten out of balance. The unions have gotten too many concessions from management. But they said this thing goes overboard. Just one example here that they cited. Under this bill, okay, there would be no right to strike. There'd be no binding arbitration for police and fire. So then you say, okay, well, what power do the unions have? Who decides these impasses if there's no agreement? And the Republican bill says, well, both sides will present their last best offers, and then the legislative body of the government agency involved, and that might be a city council when it comes to the trash collectors. It might be the state legislature when it comes to state prison guards. That legislative body will decide in the end which of the last best offers to take. Should they take the union side or should they take management side? And, you know, that's a good example where Bill Seitz said, well, that's crazy. Let me play you what he said.
That legislative body has to take either the legislative body's offer or the union's offer. What a deal. I'm going to negotiate with Senator Wagner. I have the choice of my offer or Senator Wagner's offer. I think I'll take my offer. This heads I win, tails you lose solution is also, in my opinion, likely unconstitutional.
Now let me just play you Shannon Jones. She's the sponsor of the bill, and here she is kind of defending that provision as kind of democracy in action.
The legislative body is the only one who has the ability to appropriate tax dollars. I thought it was a great compromise that we reached. It'll be an open process. Nobody can use executive session rules. It's in the public. People can weigh in on the process, much as they have now. They're directly accountable to the people. I thought it was a great compromise.
The unions, though, say it's basically just letting management decide what the final decision is.
Look, I don't believe that's the case. I think it's the ultimate in democracy. It's a public hearing. Everybody can participate in the process through a hearing, just much like they're doing now. They can talk to the individual members who are directly elected and accountable to the people.
And, of course, she makes the point. It's, you know, the taxpayers could put pressure on the city council or whoever. And that's who she says she's trying to protect in this whole process, the taxpayers, the people who pay for government.
Opponents of the measure and others like it around the country say it's the ultimate intent is to bust the unions. They're big supporters of the Democratic Party. Is there a sense that something like this, something like Senate Bill 5, could bust the unions?
Well, it certainly guts their power at the bargaining table. I think they would still be around. The unions would still be around, but boy, without much power at the bargaining table. For instance, this says state employees could negotiate only on basically wages and hours. All public workers would have to pay at least 15% of their health care premiums. Again, all the strikes would be outlawed. Binding arbitration would be outlawed. There wouldn't be longevity anymore. You know, longevity is kind of the biggest factor now in a lot of these impasses. You know, everything's decided by longevity. And this bill says, no, we're going to have merit and performance. That's what's going to base pay raises and other benefits on. And, of course, the critics say, well, okay, it sounds good, but now who's going to decide? Who's going to fairly decide these merit guidelines? Isn't there going to be favoritism? Isn't there going to be cronyism? Shannon Jones says a lot of people like the idea of merit, and even Barack Obama has said we need to move toward more merit factors when it comes to teachers. So, you know, there's a lot of contentiousness here. And it doesn't seem to be much middle ground.
The idea, it's been touted as a response to, in part, to the $8 billion or projected $8 billion shortfall in the upcoming state budget. How much actual savings does Senate Bill 5 represent for the taxpayers of Ohio?
Well, I'd say, first of all, Shannon Jones, I think even in her very first testimony, said, look, we may have an $8 billion problem. This is not going to solve it. It's not going to come close to solving even a small, it's going to maybe a small part of it. I don't think the backers have said this is going to solve $8 billion worth of a problem. But they do say it'll help some. It'll help some, and as the years go by, it will help more and more. There was a study by the Office of Collective Bargaining here, I believe, that said if this bill had been in effect a year ago, it would have saved something like $250 million for the state and something like $1 billion for cities and schools. So you can see that, okay, $250 million for the state doesn't go far. It just helps a little bit in helping plug that $8 billion budget gap. But the backers, of course, say, well, whether it's we're not saying it's going to solve everything, but it's going to help a little bit, and who should be against that?
When they come up with those figures of how much it would have saved the state a year ago, or you know, how much it would have saved local governments a year ago and that kind of thing, how are they measuring that? Are they making projections about what the governments would have done if they had had power over the pay levels and over the benefits? Because a lot of public employees already have been taking cuts. They've been taking cuts in their pay raises. They've been taking cuts. They've been contributing more to their pensions, more to their health care, that sort of a thing. How do they come up with what it would have saved?
That's a heck of a good question, and I have no answer to it. I don't know how they computed that. Your point is well taken, that the state employees and city employees have made concessions the last 2 and 3 years. We've got pay freezes. We've got 10 furlough days by state employees where they take the days off and they don't get paid. And we've had a lot of testimony from union folks down here saying, look, we've given in. What more do you want from us? And the backers of this bill say, well, you've given in some, but we need even more controls on the state and local level because we still think things are out of balance.
Okay, Bill Cohen of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Bill, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks. It's been fun.
That was Bill Cohen of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. When we return, we'll hear from a Democratic and a Republican political consultant, one each. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and for as little as $60 per year, you can support the station and get some great benefits, too. As a member at our basic level, you'll receive a WOSU member card, good for discounts at more than 200 area restaurants and attractions. You'll also receive a one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, plus electronic versions of our airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. Support the programs you love. Sign up for a basic membership today. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating our nationally ranked businesses and nonprofit leaders making our community stronger. With donors and funds in 33 Ohio counties, the Columbus Foundation, where your philanthropy and your community come together.
32 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, and a nice day with a high of 47. There's a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 37. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Well, Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Senate Bill 5. The Ohio Senate, by a narrow margin yesterday, voted in favor of Senate Bill 5. It will end collective bargaining as we know it for public employees in the state of Ohio. There are the vestiges of it are still there, but organized labor in Ohio says that it's ultimately been gutted and is relatively useless. Joining us right now to talk about that from a political point of view is Terry Casey. He's a Republican political consultant and a familiar voice and face on Columbus on the Record. Welcome, Terry.
Good morning, Ann.
Also, Dale Butland. He's a Democratic political consultant as well, a familiar face and voice from Columbus on the Record. Welcome, Dale.
Hi, Ann. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. If you want to have a comment or question for our guests, you can call us at 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, but keep those comments on the emails brief so that we can get them on the air. You know, that's my ultimate desire, is to get them on the air. So we were talking, Bill and I, at the end of the last segment about what the ultimate impact is of this financially, as far as the taxpayers are concerned. And I asked him where those projections come from that the state would have saved $250 million or local governments would have saved however many million dollars. Where do those kinds of projections come from? Terry, do you know?
Well, I think the either the Office of Budget Management, or it might have been, I think, actually DAS.
Well, that's the source of the information, but do you know what the equation is that they're looking at?
Well, I think part of it they're looking at, one of the issues in this whole thing are step increases, longevity increases, because one of the things that Kevin Bacon was on radio this morning on another station, and he noted that there ought to be more transparency in how all these things are done so that people kind of know. It'll sometimes be announced, well, this group got a 2% pay increase, but then they don't count the step increases. They don't count how much of the pensions picked up. So there ought to be more full disclosure of what all these personnel costs
are. There's the assumption that local school boards and local governments and the state, as they go back to the tables with their union representatives, will eliminate these step increases.
Well, the reality is this gives more power to the local
to do that.
Right. And I happened to sit in January in a CERB hearing with the city of Toledo. The mayor was there, and this mayor, Mike Bell, a very good, courageous Democrat, came in his office. Former fire chief, former state fire marshal for Ted Strickland, and he thought he had a $20 million deficit when he was running for mayor. It ended up being $48 million out of a $240 million budget. He had to make cuts, and five of the six unions came forward and did some very aggressive things in terms of paying their portion of the pension that they normally pay, health changes. But one of the six unions said, no, we aren't going to do anything. So one of the questions under this law is, how does a mayor like that deal with it? Frank Jackson in Cleveland, initially he said to the police, you know, we're going to have to make changes. They said, we aren't going to change. He started laying off, and then they said, let's negotiate.
But if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but Mike Bell and, Mayor of Cleveland and the Mayor of Columbus, they're not proponents of Senate Bill 5. Right, Dale?
Mike Bell is very supportive of it. As my understanding, his deputy mayor was down here testifying.
Dale?
Well, not only are the mayors opposed to it, but let's remember, we have the vast majority of the public who is also opposed to this.
Define vast majority.
I will. We've had three different polls, national polls, come out in the past week. The most recent was last night. The Wall Street Journal, that notoriously liberal organization,
well, it's actually NBC and Wall Street Journal.
62% of the American people believe that public employees should not be stripped of their collective bargaining rights. And not only that, it found that 77% believe that public employees should have the same bargaining rights as do unions in the private sector.
So the point you're making is that when you get down to the ballot box time, this is not going to be amenable to the voters, is what you're saying.
Well, not only that, look, this thing is an extremist, ideologically driven bill that won't fix the $8 billion budget deficit that we have in Ohio.
Help things down the road.
Well, but no, actually it won't, because even this study that Terry referenced, DAS study, the Case Administration, it's $200 million out of an $8 billion deficit. Do you know that we could actually fire every single state employee, not just cut their benefits, fire every single state employee, and we'd still have a $6 billion budget deficit. It is not workers that are driving the state budget deficit. And to suggest that this thing is some way to solve that problem is simply mistaken. It won't create a single job. I think that's what most people in this state are interested in, is creating jobs. It won't do that. And as I just said, it's thumbing its nose at public opinion.
I hate to bother Dale with some facts, but if you look at the roughly $50 billion two-year state budget, around 13, $14 billion of that alone is transfer payments from the state of Ohio to local schools, local communities, townships, libraries, et cetera. So an awful lot of the state budget is not just directly state employees. It's money that goes back to different units. It's also money that goes to hospitals, that type of thing. And a lot of those are covered by collective bargaining. And one of the things that I have to ask Dale, and maybe Dale's willing to get his credit card out and help pay for this, when you've got a $50 billion total to your budget and your $8 billion in the hole, one way to make up that $8 billion deficit is to increase the sales tax in Ohio by 4 cents on every single purchase you make. And in the last election, Ted Strickland wasn't advocating for higher taxes. He was running from it because he knew that that wasn't popular. So the question
he wasn't advocating for it, but he wasn't saying he wouldn't do it either. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests are Dale Butland, Democratic political consultant, and also Terry Casey, Republican political consultant.
And may I respond to something Terry just said there?
Yes.
Look, everybody understands that we're in tough economic times. Nobody suggests that there won't have to be sacrifices required. Public employees, as you said a moment ago, are already willing and already have made many of those sacrifices, and they're also willing to make more. But the sacrifice cannot simply be on the backs of the middle class and the least advantaged. Everybody should have to do their part. And I would ask my friend Terry, what have the wealthy in this state been asked to sacrifice? What have they been asked to contribute? The only thing they've done is been asked to take another tax cut with the promise of more tax cuts to come, including the estate tax, which your party wants to eliminate, which would even help the wealthy more.
So this is sort of a casting a deal and sort of a class, you know, there's class warfare going on here, then you're saying. Do you agree, Terry, that it's a middle class, lower middle class for a lot of public employees? They don't all make a ton of money versus the wealthy.
Well, this is a classic Democrat play. Let's try and have class warfare, class envy. The reality is most of the taxes in Ohio, where Ohio gets the money, and yes, people who are richer in Ohio pay a much higher income tax rate than those that are lower in their income level. Unlike the city of Columbus, which it's 2.5% on everybody, there's a graduated income tax rate in Ohio. But example, if you're going to solve an $8 billion budget deficit, one of the things that's been done in the past is increase the sales tax. The sales tax hits very squarely the broad middle class.
It's a regressive tax. So why don't we look?
So
if we're going to have tax increases, by the way, Terry, then why don't we look at things like raising some of the, creating some more brackets for really high income people? Isn't it ridiculous that we tax people who make $100 million a year at the same rate as we tax those who earn $100,000 a year? Isn't that ridiculous?
Well, actually, if you look at the tax tables, and I don't remember off the top of my head, but higher income people above, I think, $300,000 or $400,000 a year pay, it's nearly 8% plus 2.5% local income tax, and those that are lower income pay 2-4% income tax. So I hate to bother you again with the facts.
Let's go back to what the state of Ohio is actually struggling with. It's an 11% shortfall, right, in revenue, which works out to that $8 billion number that we're always talking about. If the two are related, then the downturn would appear to be more the result of the business cycle, the economy, the housing
the
issue,
Great Recession.
The Great Recession, and not necessarily a structural budgetary problem of the state. In other words, we had collective bargaining and unions were in full throttle 10 years ago when things were looking pretty darn good, at least according to my 401k. Why wasn't that a problem then and it is now?
Well, the reality is Ohio's demographics have changed and its economy.
Even in the last 10 years, that dramatically.
Absolutely. And what we've had is a combination of both Ohio's structural economic situation, competitiveness not being as good, plus the national recession that happened. And I hate to bring this up, Dale, but our current president did promise in March of 2009 with his nearly $1 trillion stimulus plan that unemployment would be held in 2009 below 8%, and by last year, 2010, it'd be down to 7%. Yeah. We're still stuck at around 9.5% unemployment.
Only someone like Terry Casey would argue that unemployment would have gone down had we not done the stimulus and the auto bailout.
That's what
and
Barack Obama promised.
A number of million. No, he didn't promise that. It turns out that the recession that was left behind by your last Republican president was even worse than anybody thought. But, and I'd like to get back to the point that you made a moment ago. Terry says that, well, Ohio's problems are the result, and this $8 billion deficit are the results of the union suffer. What I would like...
I didn't say that, Dale.
A lot of it's the mismanagement of state government. It's a lot of...
Okay,
there's
mismanagement
a lot of waste
state.
And blah,
but
blah.
But let me point out that, again, according to the Wall Street Journal, which just had a chart in it a couple of days ago, there are a whole bunch of states. In fact, about 27 states, I believe, that have deficits that are higher percentages of their overall spending than is Ohio's. Among them are Texas, Florida, Utah, Idaho, a bunch of states that have not only been run by Republicans but don't allow collective bargaining.
They're right-to-work states.
But don't allow collective bargaining.
Right.
So I would ask again, Terry, what does collective bargaining have to do with the size of this deficit?
Well, I think, as Ann quoted originally in the story, nobody promised that this bill alone solves everything. But it's part of the things, going back to the Toledo situation, the mayor there under the current collective bargaining bill, and I might mention, Dale, that collective bargaining bill in February of 83 was passed by a 17-16 vote margin in the state Senate. But nobody in 28 years has really looked at that collective bargaining bill. How has it worked? How can it be improved? Because if you look at a lot of mayors, they will tell you, and even though right now that he's running for reelection, Mike Coleman, and he got his big tax hike in August of 2009, says collective bargaining's fine. Up until then, he was saying there's problems in collective bargaining. The mayor of Akron, you talk to other mayors, other city officials around Ohio, they felt there needed to be more balance. And I might also mention that the Senate has made some major changes from when the bill was first introduced. I think it was about 500 pages. They had about 98 pages of changes. I'm sure there's going to be some changes, fixes, tweaks out of the Ohio House.
The ultimate question is, do we need to get rid of collective bargaining in order to achieve these reforms? And I would suggest to you the answer is plainly no. We just did a study. When I say we, I'm talking about this new thing. Innovation Ohio. And what it showed was that during the worst 2 years of the recession, 2008 and 2009, while the national average was a 2% increase in teacher salaries, here in Ohio there was a 4% decrease. Not only that, teachers also agreed to a whole series of reforms, doubling the number of years required for tenure, making it easier to fire bad teachers, a whole series of other things. Public employees other than teachers have made concessions of something like $700 million over the last several years.
So what about the concessions? We've talked about the concessions earlier in the program. The concessions have been out there. Is there any recognition of all the concessions that the public employees, teachers to police officers, to firefighters, and every stripe in between have made?
One of the difficulties is when people make broad generalizations, you sometimes cheat a little bit the truth. State employees, when Ted Strickland was governor, did make some major concessions, some furlough days, but that didn't apply to every public employee in the state of Ohio. Because
but at the local level, they're making concessions as well.
Well, if you look at the actual facts, district by district, some districts have said, we aren't going to ask for a 3% increase, we're going to settle for 1.3. I think that was the latest number in Westerville, but it didn't change step increases. It made some changes in health care, but different districts have done different things because different districts have different cost structures. Clearly, in the Cleveland market, it costs more for housing than it does in, say, Lima, Ohio, or Coshocton, Ohio, where I grew up.
How much do we need to know about the details of merit, the merit-based pay system that they're talking about in Senate Bill 5? Are we going to be comparing teachers in one side of Columbus with teachers in another side of Columbus, where maybe the students come from more wealth, more stability than another side of Columbus? I mean, how are you going to compare teachers even in a single district? You could take Worthington, for example, for that
well,
matter.
Well, let me give an example on merit pay and also on the seniority thing. Across America, including this week in New York, their governor, Andrew Cuomo, their mayor, Bloomberg there, hardly a right-wing Republican, is working for changes and improvements. If you have layoffs of teachers, how's it done? Solely on seniority, or do you involve merit? And I have to tell Dale, in the real world, in the 1980s, when I was on the Board of Elections, I worked with the then Democrat leader, John Jones, who'd been state or personnel chief for the city of Columbus. We did merit pay on the Board of Elections. So merit pay can be done, and it can reward those that are working harder and do better, but you've got to do it right.
Yeah, well, and let me just say that there's a whole host of problems with this. I don't think anybody objects to the thing, to the idea in principle of merit pay, and people who do better ought to be able to make
yes.
a little more. But let me give you a real-world example, Terry, since you're fond of talking about the real world. Let's say that you're a cop. And let's say that you pull over the city council president's wife for a DUI, and you know that your merit pay review is coming up. What are you going to do, Terry? Huh?
Well, that's
a real-world example. Let me also say that under this bill, when you look at teachers, one of the things that can be used for evaluation, they set out like four or five criteria, none of which are weighted more than the other. One of them is any other thing that the school board decides can be used to evaluate teachers and presumably decide how meritorious they are. Could that, Terry, mean the way the teacher dresses? Could it mean whether or not they're gay?
Well, I have a great deal of confidence in teachers, not all administrators, but a lot of administrators. I mean, teachers decide the merit of all their pupils. And some pupils dress differently, but I hope and assume most teachers are very fair in how they evaluate.
And you think the administrations will be as well?
Well, I think there's a potential to do it and do it right.
Do you think public pressure could come to bear, though, to start to influence administrations, school administrators, to make those kinds of choices about who to hire and who to fire if morality does start to come into play, if morals start to, if they can have that choice to, for whatever other reason they want to pick, to fire somebody?
Well, if you talk to professionals in the personnel area, you need to have personnel evaluations. They need to be
all of
based
that
on,
would still.
Yeah. There's a certain, I mean, at Ohio State University, I assume you have some personnel practices where employees are evaluated. Yes, there can be abuse, but part of designing the process is to make sure there's not abuse and that there's protection.
I want to get to some emails, then we need to take a break, and when we return, we want to get to some phone calls. Thanks to everybody who's called and emailed. Email from Diane, question, and if we could just answer it very quickly. In 4 years, if Democrats get into office, can this bill be changed? Is it permanent?
Well, I'll kind of jump in and say nothing in law is permanent, because one of the things in Ohio, we have the right of referendum, which might happen on this bill. There could be an initiative to create a new law, change aspects of it. Obviously, there's going to be a new election in 2012. Every one of the 99 Ohio House members are going to be up. Half or more of the state senators are going to be up. So the good thing about America is we have elections every 2 years, every 4 years, as they say, whether we need it or
so
not.
So things can
that
change.
That was Terry's idea of brevity. I will be even shorter. Yes, not only can it be changed, it will be changed, because John Kasich was not elected to repeal the 20th and 21st centuries.
And then an email from Patty in Columbus, and then really, we really will take a break. I am a Republican, and I am behind this bill for the most part because email from Patty in Columbus. Email from Robin Williamsburg. Sorry about that. I am a Republican, and I am behind this bill for the most part because I believe we have to start somewhere. That being said, I am offended and even confused by the committee process. It seems shady, if not almost illegal, for the committee chair to be able to throw someone off committee that isn't going to vote the way the party feels they should. If this can be done, why not just skip the committee process altogether? Terry, how do you feel about that? Bill Seitz, longtime Republican, and Scott Olslager, again, a very longtime Republican, been around for 20 plus years.
Well, there's two parts to the question. One, I think the committee process was good because
it wasn't shady. It was completely illegal. It was completely legal.
Well, but the committee process, I think they had 3 or 4 days of hearings, hours and hours. I know one of the nights, one of the state senators called me about 10:30 at night as he was coming back from hearings that started at 10 a.m.
Well,
in the morning.
Good point, Terry, though, but is that really the best way to do business? I mean, to sit and bang on something for 10 or 12 hours in one day, really, is that how the mind intellectually operates the
most
efficiently? Well,
in my view, that is part of the process. It's not the whole process,
okay,
because people, both pro and con, had a chance to speak. People had a chance to be in the atrium, be in other parts of the State House, hear what was testified. So I think it was good to have that process.
Do you find it a bit amusing that Terry and his colleagues screamed to high heaven when reconciliation, you remember that term, when reconciliation was used to pass the health care bill in Washington? But, you know, at least when we used reconciliation, every senator was allowed to vote and nobody was yanked out of a committee to keep them from voting a certain way and to ensure the right outcome.
Okay, we have to take a break. When we return, we'll return to our conversation as well with my guest, Terry Casey. He's a Republican political consultant, and also Dale Butland. He's a Democratic political consultant. And hopefully we'll get to some of those phone calls, so stay there with us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Two years after opening his award-winning Chicago restaurant, Alinea, famous for its avant-garde menu, Chef Grant Achatz was diagnosed with stage 4 tongue cancer. After radiation and chemo, he lost his sense of taste, but it's been returning, and he's about to open a new restaurant. And he's written a new memoir, which we'll talk with him about on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Sunday night on WOSU-TV, celebrate 25 years of Les Miserables, as a company of more than 300 actors and musicians perform together on one stage. Watch the Les Miserables 25th Anniversary Concert. It's Sunday evening at 7 on WOSU-TV. 32 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today and a pretty nice day with a high of 47. There's a slight chance of rain tonight with a low of 37 degrees. Rain showers are likely throughout the day on Friday with a chance of a thunderstorm in the morning, a high of 52. More rain Friday night and more thunderstorms possible, a low of 46 degrees. Looking ahead to Saturday, rain showers are expected, a high of 55. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Senate Bill 5. That is what the state Senate did yesterday. It, by a narrow margin, although that's not unusual, things are narrow these days, voted in favor of a bill that will end collective bargaining, as I keep putting it, as we know it. We're going to talk more about what exactly do we mean by ending collective bargaining or not, as the case may be. Some people say it's been gutted. Other people say, no, it's still there. It's still functioning. It can still be very, very helpful. We'll talk about that more. First, I do want to get to some callers. And Joseph from Mentor, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. I have a question. Why State Senator Tim Grendel, who wrote a letter to the committees that brought some very valid points that SB 5 would be a failure. One of those points was if you take away collective bargaining and our grievance procedure, all we are left is with lawyers, and won't that cost the local governments even more money just trying to figure out small problems that we could mediate through the grievance procedure?
Okay, so does Senate bill eliminate the grievance procedure?
Well, there's different ways to deal with grievances. I served on the library board with Bob Farrington, who was head of the building trades in Ohio. And he told me with the building trades, most of their grievances get resolved in the field. In government, there tend to be more written grievances. So there's still going to be grievances. There's still going to be, I mean, mayors are accessible people that people can talk to. And there's still a role for CERB. on unfair labor practices.
The State Employee Relations Board.
Right. There's functions still there. So it's going to change. That doesn't mean there's no collective bargaining, there's no avenue for grievances.
Well,
so,
Dale? But look, and I think this is a very important point, Ann. I think that the listeners need to understand what exactly has happened here. By outlawing the right to strike, by repealing binding arbitration for public safety employees, and by setting up a dispute mechanism where one side gets to dictate the terms in the end, you have turned collective bargaining into a sham. And not only that, let's understand what this does. Not only do workers lose the right to strike, but if they do strike, they can be fined, fired, and ultimately thrown in jail.
That's wrong. They amended the bill yesterday.
Forgive me, Terry. They did not amend it. I actually went back, and we had this check this morning. They just put one extra step in it so that you have to get a contempt finding from a judge. But once you do that, you can jail them. So that is exactly what's happening. So, in other words, we don't have collective bargaining anymore in Ohio if this thing ultimately passes. We're going to have collective begging.
What about the idea that the civil lawsuits will become more of an is it possible that lawyers could start to get involved and it could be mucked out that way?
Well, we already have lawyers involved anyway, so there's always going to be lawyers involved.
But we're talking about lawsuits.
Well, if you listen
lawsuit
to,
lawyers.
And I know Tim Girdell well, known him and his wife very, very long time. He indicated on the floor of the Senate he agrees with about 85% that's in
yes.
the bill. And clearly he'd like to see some changes done by Bill Batchelor in the House side. They might make those changes and might be able to smooth out some of those issues so that you can better deal with some of these things without going through the litigation process.
Is the House arguably more conservative, more pro-Senate Bill 5? Is it supposed to be a wider margin of support for it in the House, Dale?
I would be very surprised if the House modified this in any significant way.
Could it make it more, well, the Ohio Liberty Council, for instance, has called for Senate Bill 5 to include three planks that it currently does not have. Government employees should have the freedom to choose whether they belong to a union. Government unions should not be able to use an employee's dues for political purposes without the consent of the employee. Government employee benefits should be realigned with those of the private sector by ending the conversion of years of banked sick days into large cash payments. Couldn't those things be added into the bill in the House?
Well, there's some members in the House who want to make the bill more conservative. You also have in Bill Batchelder as House Speaker. Not only a lawyer, but a very well-respected constitutional lawyer. Mm-hmm. Also, the governor and his people are looking at some of these legal aspects. So there's been questions raised on aspects of the bill, and my sense is there's going to be some changes made in the House. My guess is organized labor is not going to be happy because they want to keep what we have today. And in my view, and if you look at other polling like the Quinnipiac poll from yesterday, the public out there believes by a 63-31 margin that, yes, public employees need to pay more of their benefits and retirement programs.
And public employees, Terry, we've been over this and over this. Public employees are willing to do that. They have already done that. But I think this brings up the broader point that what the Ohio Liberty Council wants to do is make the bill even more draconian for
labor. And do you think
labor.
That they could succeed in the House, though?
Well, I think they very well might be able to succeed.
Here is the point.
Which we haven't gotten to yet, and that is if this bill does not solve the budget deficit, if it doesn't create jobs, and if public employers are already making a lot of the concessions that everyone says are needed and necessary, then what is this bill about? It's not about the three R's. It's about the three P's. It's about politics. It's about power, and it's about payback. It's about destroying unions and removing the power of those folks who don't always vote for Republicans. That's what this is at base.
Bill from Powell, you're on the air. You're on the fence about Senate Bill 5.
I am. My question would be, it would be interesting. You know, we know you disagree, both your participants disagree. There's got to be one point that both Dale and Terry might agree on. I'd like to know what that point is. In other words, Dale, is there some issue that you would give to Terry that is true?
Well, I'm not going to speak for Terry, but I will tell you what I think we agree on, Everybody agrees that in tough economic times there have to be sacrifices. I don't disagree with that. I think that maybe some of the pensions, some of the health benefits for public employees and some of the other things they have, maybe those do need to be modified. That's not the issue, though. The issue is, do you need to get rid of collective bargaining to do it? I say no. He says yes.
Terry,
well, I think one thing that doesn't always be heard is we've got lots of really dedicated public employees, police, fire, teachers, people that work in state government, and they all deserve a good wage and good benefits. One of the questions, though, that's come up, when you look and compare what's happened in the private sector, when you talk to people, including in the news media, what they're paying on their health benefits, and they look at some of these people that are putting nothing in as far as their health care, it doesn't seem fair to the taxpayers, and those are the middle class. But we've got great workers in Ohio.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate your call. Patty in Columbus emailed us. She says, why does the public feel state employees are not taxpayers, too? Why didn't the fact that so many people went downtown to protest this bill didn't seem to matter in the end? Don't the representatives and senators represent the state workers, too? So they do pay taxes. They make decent wages that will pay. Now they will pay less in taxes. The state, the revenue from income tax will go down.
Well, this is a state of 11.5 million people. And, yes, there's 50,000 or so state employees, but the system, you got to figure out what's fair for everybody, including the taxpayers, and we got to make sure Ohio is not as uncompetitive as what it's been.
But I think the caller makes an excellent point, and that is the people who are opposed to this bill are not just state workers. As we've just been discussing, there are well over 60% of the population who does not believe this bill should have been passed, who thinks that the public workers should retain collective bargaining rights.
And they still have collective bargaining.
They don't. It's a sham, Terry. You know that, and I know that. What kind of bargaining is it when one side gets to dictate the outcome?
Don't you think if it's in a public forum, though, when the legislative body, be it the school board or the city council or village council or whatever it might be, if they have to do it in front of the public instead of behind closed doors, do you think that there's any value to that?
Absolutely not. The reason that you had, the reason we had binding arbitration before is that you have a neutral third party who gets offers from both sides. Here, it's not a neutral third party. It's one of the sides.
Now,
one of the sides of the bargaining gets to make the decision.
The opponents of binding arbitration say, yeah, in theory you have a neutral third party, but by and large, the neutral third party's side, this is what they say, side with labor.
And to quote my friend Terry, that simply doesn't square with the facts.
Okay.
The Dispatch ran a front page story 3 Sundays ago in which they looked at the total number of cases of contract disputes between public safety forces and local governments. What they found was less than 2% ever go to binding arbitration. When they do go to binding arbitration, the arbitrators have decided an exactly equal number of times for management and for labor, and the average award was a 2% increase. So please give me a break, Terry. It's not that there's all these outlandish awards.
But before it ever reaches binding arbitration, there's the idea that the management side of the equation doesn't want to have to go that far, that it's expensive and it's costly and it takes time and energy. And they feel like they're bullied into just bargaining and settling.
And you're exactly right. If you look,
I don't know if I'm right, but
if you talk to the mayor of Akron, he's been very frustrated by the collective bargaining, having this arbitrator who doesn't live in the community, doesn't have any stake in worrying about how it financially all works out.
Except what Terry always forgets to mention is that all these mayors he's talking about support collective bargaining and want to keep binding arbitration.
Dale, when you say all these mayors, you're just not telling the truth.
Mayor of
talk
Akron,
to Mike Bell.
The mayor of Akron is the one that you just mentioned. The mayor of Columbus is another one.
Go back and read the Akron Beacon Journal over the past 3 years and what he said about the police union and the binding arbitration.
Matthew from Fairborn, you're on the air. You're in the middle on this.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I think both sides should compromise and not make it about party politics. But my question is, if all Ohio employees are subject to these demands, what about the elected officials, the governor, the legislature, and merit pay? Shouldn't they be responsible and accountable to the Ohio people and give the Ohio people a say, either through a ballot measure or something else, as so their pay increases or decreases or whatever else?
Well, to a certain extent, we have merit pay. It's called elections. And in 2012, all the members of the Ohio House and half the members of the state Senate are going to be on the ballot, and the public can fire them if they don't like it, and governors have four-year terms, and you can fire them. The part of the reality is public employees generally are not on two- or four-year terms.
Well, you know, I think that the caller raises an interesting question, because we're talking about the matter of shared sacrifice again, and apparently everybody should sacrifice except, A, the wealthy, we've already established that, and members of Governor Kasich's senior staff. You know, the chief of staff under the last governor received $123,000 a year. The current governor's chief of staff earns $170,000 a year. The public relations person under the last governor received $89,000 a year. That's been raised to $120,000.
And Dale, compared to the salaries at Ohio State, where the PR person makes $330,000 and the right-hand person, Gordon Gee, makes $600,000.
We don't have to compare this to Ohio State. My point is this. If sacrifice is necessary, shouldn't those senior people with the governor be setting a good example and starting to sacrifice a little themselves instead of doubling the salary?
Most recently, people have wondered about the $60,000 pay to the members of the commission that will oversee gambling in the state of Ohio. It's a part-time job, and people have been surprised at the level of pay for them as a part-time job.
Well, in Pennsylvania, they pay their gambling commission people about $150,000 a year, and Maryland pays them zero. So I don't know what the right figure is. I know Joanne Davidson very well, and my guess is on an hourly basis for the time she's going to put in on the casino commission, she's going to earn that $60,000 or more, because there's a lot of work to be done in setting it up, getting it organized.
Except there, too, there's a certain amount of hypocrisy. She's a lovely lady. I have nothing against her at all, but she's
former House Speaker.
But she's a double dipper, too. She's going to be getting the salary on top of her pension. Now, double dipping is something that you Republicans say you want to get rid of with civil servants, but not for the people who are at the
top
of the food chain.
I want to get one more phone caller in here. Keith.
Yeah, hi. It's my understanding that there's a lot of federal money that's contingent upon us, upon the states having collective bargaining agreements, and that we are in jeopardy of losing some of that federal money, which is obviously going to make the deficit worse. Is there any truth in that, and can you address that issue?
Terry, yeah. Is that a concern?
I'm not sure legally whether that's true, because you've got so many different federal departments, federal programs. I know somebody said that, but I don't know whether that's true.
We don't know yet.
No.
There are two specific areas right now that I'm familiar with. One of them has to do with several hundred million dollars worth of transportation funds that we are in danger of losing if this Senate Bill 5 becomes law. The other one is the race to the top money. We had several hundred million dollars there.
And collective bargaining is a function of that?
No, but what it is, but the reason we got the money was because of the standards that were put in place, particularly with respect to teacher valuation. Those are all being thrown out now under this bill. So that money is potentially at risk. And all I can say
notice
is when you have an $8 billion deficit, we can't afford to be giving back hundreds of millions of dollars.
30 seconds. This isn't a debate, but we do have a minute and a half left before we have to go off the air, which means I have about 30 seconds left for each of you. So, Terry?
Well, this is a long process, and the bigger part of the process is coming later this month when the budget rolls out. Ohio's got a major problem, both in its budget being out of whack, and it needs to get more jobs, attract more industry.
But what does this bill do on that score?
Well, part of it gives local officials more tools in terms of dealing with their costs, because roughly 80% of a school district, of a local community, their costs are personnel costs.
Which is true in any business.
Well, but it's especially true in government, because right now people are not in the mode for a 4% sales tax increase.
Dale, I got about 30 seconds.
I would say that this bill, Senate Bill 5, is just a classic example of overreaching and of doing things on the part of the legislature that they weren't elected to do. They were elected to create jobs, not destroy workers' rights. And by thumbing their nose at public opinion and by intentionally misstating both the facts and their own motives, I think if they keep this up, they're going to pay a heavy price at the polls in 2 years.
That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guest, Dale Butlin, Democratic political consultant. Welcome. Thanks for being here today, Dale.
Pleasure.
And also Terry Casey, Republican political consultant. Terry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Thanks for writing. This is All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus. And streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.